Hello, and welcome to New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. Campaigners from Papua New Guinea, Africa, mainland USA and Hawaii will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences about Indigenous people that are too often missed by mainstream media. Where land is being won back from miners, how words of self-determination are being spread, and what resources are being protected from corporate exploitation. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Jim Brooks, an Australian lawyer who's worked with Aboriginal people for the last two decades, with the people in issues of Cape York most recently. The forced removal of Indigenous kids has shamed countries like Canada and the United States. Jim was the chief administrator on Australia's Stolen Children's Inquiry. He heard more than a year of testimony from Australian Aboriginal people. Can you share a few of those stories with us, Jim?
One of the overwhelming recollections that I have of the inquiry is that of the hundreds and hundreds of interviews that people gave to us, the hundreds and hundreds of stories that people told, they were typically about sexual and physical abuse in the institutions they were placed in. And they told us continually about the efforts that they made, either as kids or as parents, to find their families again and to get back together. I also remember that we were struck at the time that we found it impossible to find a single mother who could talk to us about the experience of having their child removed. Invariably, those mothers weren't around anymore. They'd basically died of grief and despair.
That's a shocking thing. Is there one that sticks out in your mind, Jim?
Well, I guess one of the stories that I remember clearly was a family of five kids being removed, and those kids were sent to different parts of the country. I mean, it always struck me that if those children had walked into a government welfare office of some kind and asked to be flown to Perth because they wanted to go there, they would have been turned down, but the government managed to send these kids off to different states. And importantly, It placed the kids in different environments depending on their skin colour. For example, the child with the darker skin was sent to an institution, and the child with the lighter skin was fostered into a fairly affluent, non-Indigenous family. And those with skin colours in between went to different locations. And those five kids met up later in life, and it set up an enormous tension between them about the different upbringings that they'd had even after removal.
So they were shot in the foot before they even started, really, weren't they, as a family? Australia's Royal Commission into the Disproportionate Amount of Aboriginal Deaths in Prison Custody, reported in 1991, and the report of the other national investigation, the Stolen Children's Inquiry that you worked on, released its report in 1997. Between them, they made over 400 recommendations. Broadly, Jim, what improvements have you seen from those recommendations?
I think it's fair to say that there have been very few improvements. Specifically, some of the recommendations that the Stolen Children's Inquiry made that have been acted upon really relate to the provision of counselling services for individuals who were traumatised by their experience. And generally that hasn't been as a result of any particular government initiative. It's been as a result of Indigenous health organisations rejigging their priorities in order to meet that demand. Most of the recommendations of the Stolen Children Inquiry simply haven't been implemented, and there's never been a coordinated effort by government to do that. Similarly, although there are boxes and boxes of reports and responses to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal on Death in Custody, that hasn't really translated into on-the-ground changes. the whole question of deaths in custody and the relationship of Indigenous people to the police service and, I guess, underlying racist attitudes of government have come to the fore in Queensland recently with the death in custody at Palm Island of Runji. The background to that is that a man who was watching the state police arrest someone sang out and was fairly cheeky to the state police. He was promptly arrested and taken to the police station. Within half an hour, he was dead. His liver was split in two. He had fractured ribs and had injuries that were basically consistent with being jumped on or bashed by a person of considerable strength and from some height.
Yeah, so while these reports have been sitting on a shelf and gathering dust, Jim, how would that have helped in the situation on Palm Island that you've just been describing?
Well, it would have prevented the whole thing from occurring. The Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, Stolen Children's Report, the National Inquiry into Racist Violence, all of these things are a decade or a decade and a half old, and they provide blueprints to avoid exactly this sort of thing happening. If the recommendations of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody had been followed, Murrunji would never have been arrested for being cheeky to the copper.
Yeah, right.
Secondly, once he was arrested, the police wouldn't have assaulted him.
Yes.
Secondly, or thirdly, once he was placed in the cell, his condition would have been monitored to make sure that, as in this case, when he had a life-threatening condition, he got some medical attention. But the initial thing was that he should never have been arrested, and the Royal Commission made it clear that Aboriginal people were overrepresented in custody, partly because they were arrested at an enormous rate for public order offences, which they should be dealt with on summons.
Yes. We're talking about two tragedies here, the disproportionate deaths in custody of Aboriginal people and also the psychological, physical and economic and social effects on whole generations after they've been removed from their parents. Severing the connection between Aboriginal people and their land looms large as an issue in both. What's the connection, Jim?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Royal Commission made specific references and recommendations regarding physical custody and the way to monitor people in custody and care for them properly. But also the Royal Commission drew attention to the underlying issues that lead to overrepresentation in custody, and they were the attitudes of police and their behaviour towards Indigenous people, the hopelessness of many Indigenous communities and people within them as a result of the socioeconomic circumstances of Aboriginal people, including the really well-documented poor health, lack of education opportunities and lack of income and lack of opportunities to determine how they live. And the Royal Commission tried to address that question of deliberate and systemic disempowerment of Indigenous people and said that basically that was what was leading to the overrepresentation in custody.
Well, we're going to Africa now to see how some of those issues play out in action. Let's go to Botswana, where brave bushmen are returning to their ancestral land after being forcibly evicted by government forces throughout the last 10 years. Their land, the Central Kalahari Game Reserve, lies in the middle of the world's richest diamond fields. A company, jointly owned by the gem miner De Beers and the Botswana government, effectively controls diamond mining in Botswana, and they stood to profit most from mining the land. In December, Botswana's High Court found that these evictions were unlawful, paving the way for the bushmen to finally return home. Jamanda is one of them. He's from the organisation, the First People of the Kalahari. What was it like returning to your homeland, Jamanda?
The ruling from the High Court have given us clarity and powers. The rule was a shock. And to us, it's really a victory in Africa and to all Indigenous around the world. It's a victory.
Indeed.
To all Indigenous people in the world.
Absolutely. Can you tell me how it feels, though? Like, what is the importance to you of your land and to returning to your land?
Very proud. Even our ancestors are very happy to see us coming back and lighting fire, the more we make fire in our houses and the light comes on, is the more our ancestors get happy that we are there. And our ancestors are the only people who can protect us from everything. They can give us food.
And how do you know that your ancestors are with you, and how do you know that they're happy?
That's a religion, because the first day when we went back, they were dancing. It's just like a magic thing.
And I understand that one of the High Court judges said that really, if you had not been able to return to your land, that effectively you would have starved. In other words, that being evicted from your homelands would have wiped you out as a race. The eviction from your homeland must have been very painful for you and your people. Where and how were you living during this eviction, Jamanda?
Families doesn't know how to go and find food for their own. And that was very difficult for them. And each and every one was just getting alcoholism. And people doesn't know what to do. They were not even familiar with the area. A lot of people, they specialize on drinking alcohol. A bloody problem to my people.
Mm. And it's not quite over yet, is it? I see that the government forces recently arrested 6 bushmen and virtually starved them for 4 days before releasing them without charge. What was that about, Jamanda?
Listen, I just want to come to this fight. 1987 and 1984, Minister Mutakulumako and Minister Balaji went and told us that we have to move. This issue is from ministers. A lot of people blaming that, but it's from the government itself. So we believe we have been kicked out because of government.
Mm.
Anyone who doesn't like or who doesn't know about that can call Jamanda on this mobile phone, 00-267-71-90-99-22. Jamanda can explain that to the world.
Thank you very much, Jamanda. One last question before we go. What are your plans for the reserve now you're back?
We are going back home. And now, our government say that it's not even interested of taking care of us. So what we ask for the government is to give us a chance to practice our own traditional life.
Jamanda, thank you very much for talking to us today. That was Jamanda Hakanabori from the First People of Kalahari. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know how busy you are at the moment, Jamanda, and good luck for your future. Chris Richards, and you're listening to New Internationalist, broadcast on community radio stations around the world, like the one you're listening to now. Hanani K. Trask has just dropped in for a chat from Hawaii. She's an Indigenous human rights advocate, scholar, writer, and a poet. As a wordsmith, Hanani, is there a language of dispossession?
Yes, I would say that there is, and it's both in our native language and in the English language. We have two legal languages in the state, and both of them have words that describe dispossession, that describe what we call in our own way a kind of homelessness. Our language was not, for example, unbanned until about 10 years ago. It was a banned language. We couldn't speak it in schools. The old folks could speak it to each other at home, but it wasn't a public language. Fortunately, after 20 years of struggle, we changed that. So now it has been re-legalized, and we have immersion schools for young people, and almost all of my students now speak Hawaiian. But it's that kind of situation, and that's a dispossession not just of a people and their land, but of their whole sense of who they are. If you don't have a language that is your own, you don't understand the world that you live in. And so I think in many ways language is even more important than real estate, as the Americans call it, because we're not interested in money. We're interested in continuity as a people, and we can't have that unless we at least have the language, and then from there onwards to repossessing our lands and our waters and having some form of self-government. But first comes the language.
Yes, I understand that independence in Hawaiian means the true person of the land.
Yes, and in fact, it's a very interesting kind of expression, because if people are in their own place and speak their own language, then they understand both who they are and the nature of their relationship to the land. But when that has been taken away from them, for example, American Indians, now the United States calls land, as I say, real estate. And right there you can see the dispossession. It's not just of terra firma, of the earth. It's of the whole meaning of who you are. Native people are indigenous people. They are people of the land. So you lose all of that in one generation or less, really half a generation, because the identity that you have with your language and your land is the same identity a child has with their mother.
Mm.
And once you don't have that, you've been severed.
Well, let's take some examples. What about the language of self-determination? We've talked about independence. I understand, too, that people and nation are the same word in Hawaiian. Now, that's important, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's a very good point. Lahui is people and nation, and individuals have a different phrasing, but when you say the Lahui, as Hawaiians do to each other today, you mean all of us, not just people you know. And, for example, we include the diaspora in that, because at some point, unfortunately probably very soon, we will have more Hawaiians living on the American continent than living in Hawaii. And part of that out-migration has to do with 26 American military bases, 6.5 million tourists. Hawaiians are literally being shoved out of our own archipelago. And that's why the term and the language of the native people, Lahui, is very important, because only one of us, in terms of all the ethnic groups in Hawaii, can be called a Lahui, and that's the native people. So language is intimate to understanding.
Yes, and it emphasizes community too, doesn't it? A special community, and seems to run contrary to the, I don't know, the me, myself, I ideology of the U.S.
Yes.
Is that an important thing, do you think, in terms of the way that Hawaiians see themselves?
Yes. I don't think Hawaiians even think of themselves individually. For example, families called Ohana in Hawaiian are your base, and as opposed to, say, property. And it's very difficult, which is why the diaspora is so painful for people. It's very difficult to just live on your own. Now, the Americans, they love individualism. They call it rugged individualism. That, to us, is comical. Human beings are not a world apart. They are together. That's why they're called human. So the idea that you live by yourself and you achieve by yourself is just so foreign to us. And I've met many other peoples who are indigenous in the Pacific and elsewhere, and it's remarkable how everyone has the same sense that we are a people as opposed to just individuals.
Well, you've written an acclaimed book called From a Native Daughter, Colonialism and Sovereignty in Hawaii, published by the University of Hawaii Press. Right now you're working on a new book of poetry. Can you share with us a couple of your new poems and tell us what their significance is, Hanani?
Yes. Here's a good one, I think, that starts with what happened at contact, which I'm sure your listeners, especially Aborigines, will identify with this. I titled it The Wounds of Our Nation. The wounds of our nation are the children, those with chained eyes and scarred faces, those floating out at sea, face down in salt, the children of poisoned fields, burnt skies, drowned islands, the children without history or memory, the children at the far shore, watching from the beach as the first ships came in.
Wow, that's a bleak message. Is that the imagery you're wanting to create with this, Hanani?
Well, I wanted people to know that the wound that was created at contact continues till this very moment, that with Cook and disease and then following American explorers came a huge population collapse. The estimate now is that we were between 800,000 and a million Hawaiians, and within 20 years, we were down to something like 200,000. So I think the story of disease is the first part of what colonization brings. The same thing happened to American Indians, except it took longer because there were more of them, or I should say the Indians of the Americas. So depopulation is the first wound, and you can't recover from it when it's that quick. It just takes everything, and within a very short span, of course, we had the overthrow of the government, and I don't think that would have succeeded before contact because we were much stronger as a people. But once diseases and more settlers came into Hawaii, it was almost doomed in terms of lack or loss, I should say, of self-government.
Mm. And you have another poem for us too, Hanani?
Yes, here's a good one. The Secret, 1893. White Americans and black male, a native queen, from the gunboats, swarms of blue jackets. In her palace, a conspiracy of thieves, at once a fallen government, Hawaii, this murdered country, lying by the roadside of history.
And again, a message of past colonialization and loss. How has this been greeted by, for instance, people who have read it in the United States?
Oh, they're shocked. Most of them have never heard of the overthrow. It never dawns on them to look at a map and see that we're 2,500 miles from California.
Let's finish with one more poem. Do you have another one for us, Hanani?
Yes. What would you like this one to be?
What about a message of inspiration for people?
Yes. That would be very good. Let me find something. I hate to say this, but I can't find a single cheerful one. I'm looking at them right now.
Hanani, Jim Brooks, a lawyer who worked on the Australian Stolen Generations Inquiry, is also talking with us today.
Excellent.
Jim, in a conversation we had a while back, I was struck by your observations about describing Aboriginal people as blacks and the connotation that brings with it.
Yes, Chris, that's right. I have to say, though, I was really struck by Hanani not being able to easily locate a positive or uplifting poem. And there was an experience that I had, too, after the Stolen Children's Inquiry. I was speaking at an event about the inquiry, and someone, after I'd reeled off a whole lot of horrible stories, said, "Isn't there a positive story?" And it took full minute, I think, before I could think of a positive story that involved the reuniting of a family, some kids who had been taken 20 years before from their family and taken to Melbourne, managed to get themselves on a bus and travelled to South Australia to look at the country where they knew their family had originated. And they stepped off the bus and off in the distance under a tree there are a number of people sitting, and after the bus drove away they looked around, wondered where they should go, and they walked across to where the old ladies were sitting under the tree, and the old ladies turned out, of course, to be their aunts, and they just simply said, "We've been waiting for you." And I think it is important that often in Indigenous experience there aren't a lot of happy stories, and that's worth keeping in mind that people are entitled to be angry and serious about what's been a pretty sustained record of dispossession. On that question of language too, I was also struck then in the way that it seems that all around the Pacific, everyone finds it hard to say the name Cook. Yes. I think people had some recognition of his skill as a navigator, but
Captain Cook, of course, being
a bit overwhelmed about the consequences of his actions and what flowed from it. On the question of naming, I think that's right. I mean, the whole question of naming has been relevant throughout occupation of Indigenous land, that when Europeans came to Australia, they ignored the names the individuals had for themselves, which spelled out what that person's role and relationship might have been, and gave them names that were usually pretty common or diminutive names.
Or religious names too.
Yeah, that's right, which had no relevance to the recipient of the new name. And also, you know, some pretty casual sort of naming processes. One community that I've done some work with, their people there were given the names of domestic items that could be easily spotted around a campfire.
What, tables and kettles and things?
Very similar to that, that's right. And it reflected the low regard, of course, that people had for the Indigenous people of the country.
Absolutely. That says so much, doesn't it? Reducing them to inanimate objects. And this word black, Jim, you know, the connotation is, like, we use black in so many different ways, broader in language, other than naming Aboriginal people or naming Afro-American people or naming people in Africa. It also connotes dirt or something evil, whereas white is, you know, pure and angelic and clean. Yeah. Does this have resonance for you, Hanani?
Yes, absolutely. The Americans are obsessed with color and what they call blood quantum, so it's a way to make people disappear as well. We have two federal laws that govern the lands in part that were taken by the U.S. at annexation, and you have to have a certain blood quantum in order to even get on a waiting list for the land, which is such an irony given that they belong to us for thousands of years, and the Americans come in and say, hey, you have to be this much blood quantum, you have to prove it by birth certificates, which of course are an American imposition, and then you get on a waiting list, and I think now the waiting list is something like over 20,000 people.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a farce.
Mm. Well, look, thanks for joining us today, Hanani. That was Hanani K. Trask. You can hear another interesting interview about language that Hanani did with us on our very first program by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. And look out for her new book of poems, which will be released by the University of Hawaii in the not-too-distant future, Hanani.
Yes. Thank you for that.
Good luck, and we look forward to speaking to you again.
Yes, thank
Aloha.
You very much. Aloha.
Moving right along now, we're going now from Hawaii to West Papua, a troubled territory that, without the proper consent of its people, was absorbed into the Republic of Indonesia 40 years ago. The guns of the Indonesian military are still keeping the West Papuans down. Edmund McWilliams was a former political counsel in the US Embassy in Jakarta in the 1990s and is now a prominent advocate for West Papuan human rights. Let's start with the recent attacks by the military in the Central Highlands of West Papua, Ed. What happened and why?
Well, we're very concerned back here on the basis of reports we're getting from the field inside West Papua, but also from friends in Australia and elsewhere, that new military operations that they've launched since last December have resulted in a real humanitarian crisis, particularly in the area of Puncak Jaya, where thousands of people have been forced from their homes, sometimes into the forest or the jungles, or sometimes into neighboring villages. And lack of food and medical assistance has led to significant hardship for these people. We have reports of some deaths as a result of the conditions these people have been forced into. Moreover, we've also heard of some extrajudicial killings of civilians by the Indonesian military and the militarized police, the BRIMOB.
And what's the reason for this, Ed?
There's sort of an approximate cause, which was apparently a conflict between the small armed resistance, the OPM, back in early December, where allegedly the OPM killed two Indonesian soldiers. But more broadly speaking, we've seen a pattern of these military operations launched in West Papua over the last decade or so, and indeed probably longer than that, whereby the military will stage operations for literally for months, driving people out of their villages. Often the houses are burned and public buildings are burned by the military. And as a consequence, we see reports of hundreds of people killed, either directly by the conflict, by the military itself, or as a consequence of their being forced into non-sustainable situations.
One of the reasons that people working within the country also say is that the Indonesian military need to justify their existence. I suppose that given that the Indonesian military only gets about a third of its money from the Indonesian government, they've got to take up creative means of getting that money by other ways. And one of them is to justify their existence in the country, but also to go into security arrangements or alternatively business arrangements with, for instance, logging companies to actually grab some money that way and put it in the coffers of either the military generally or in specific officers' pockets. I'm wondering if logging or security arrangements has anything to do with this current conflict, Ed.
It's quite likely that that is the case. Broadly speaking, the Indonesian military has often provoked communal conflicts in places like Aceh or previously in East Timor and certainly in West Papua, where by virtue of the fact of their presence, they are able to essentially exploit natural resources and also extort money both from local firms and from international companies, most famously in West Papua, the Freeport mining firm, which has had a very corrupt relationship with the Indonesian military for decades.
Mm. And you were a senior service officer with the US State Department attached to the Indonesian embassy when a similar thing happened at Mapanduma, Ed, in the 1990s, weren't you?
That's right. Back in 1996, early 1996, there was a conflict between the Indonesian military, particularly the infamous Kopassus troops, the Special Forces troops, and a small band of the OPM, the Organized Resistance to Indonesian Presence, that resulted from the kidnapping of some Westerners. The Westerners eventually freed themselves, basically broke free of their captors, but the Indonesian military pursued a military campaign against this very small band of OPM that ranged across much of the territory north of Timika and Tembagapura into the Mapanduma area. As an officer there at the embassy, I was constantly trying to obtain information about what was going on in that region. But typically what happens is the military will prevent any kind of access to this area, certainly by reporters such as myself or journalists, but also even by those who would be prepared to provide humanitarian assistance to this besieged civilian population. And what we monitored over a period of many months was a gradual loss of the population there, deaths in the hundreds among the civilian population, a real tragedy that went largely unremarked in the rest of the world.
Yes. I mean, it's a real problem. I know myself, because I've only done a magazine on West Papuans and run a conference here in Australia, I've actually been placed on the enemy of state list for Indonesia,
right.
Which means effectively that I won't be able to get into Indonesia. And that means that you aren't able to go in and actually see the human rights abuses that are happening and report that to the outside world. It's a very effective tool, Ed.
Well, that's right. Also, you might add, in addition to that, those people within Papua who try to monitor and essentially get word out about these abuses, that is to say local Papuans, be they members of the church or human rights organizations like ELSAM, they themselves face tremendous intimidation, and some have actually had to flee the country because of the military's attacks on them for their efforts to get the truth out.
Going to the US now, it's heartening to see that at last West Papua is getting some international attention. Most recently I saw in the British House of Lords in January when Lord Harries of Pentregarth rose to ask the British government what they were doing to promote West Papuan independence. Fantastic that it's even being talked about in a parliamentary level within Britain that was missing for so long. You've been helping to stop US arms from being used against the West Papuans. How will the change in power to the Democrats in the US Congress help the West Papuans now, do you think, Ed?
Well, we're very hopeful that there will be a change. We've seen a disastrous turn in the last 2 years in the US Congress, in which basically the Congress had prevented assistance to the Indonesian military from the United States for well over a decade. But then beginning in 2005 and then throughout 2006, we saw the administration essentially using the argument that they needed the Indonesian military as partners in the war on terrorism, successful in the Congress in basically removing a lot of those restrictions. We're hopeful now that with Democrats in control of the House of Representatives and narrowly in the Senate, that we'll begin to see some reimposition of restrictions on the assistance to the Indonesian military, focusing on the fact that it remains a highly corrupt institution, unaccountable before the courts, and, of course, perpetrators of tremendous human rights abuse in Indonesia.
Yes, I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it? You and others like you in America have been telling Congress for ages that there have been human rights abuses within West Papua, and nevertheless, those sales of arms have opened up in America under the Bush administration, and so too an exchange of military education, I understand it, too, Ed.
Yes, that's right. Well, what is particularly ironic is that, as I say, the administration has used this argument that they need the TNI as a partner in the war on terror, totally ignoring the fact that the TNI has very close relations with a number of Islamic fundamentalist militias inside Indonesia, such as Laskar Jihad and Front for the Defense of Islam. And in a sense, raising, I think, very serious questions about what kind of partner the TNI would actually be.
Well, the war on terror is another front entirely, Ed, and I understand that you're on that front as well. You've been working on the removal of rights of detainees still held by the US at Guantanamo Bay. Tell us what the mood of America is like on this issue, Ed.
I think we can say, to begin with, we are seeing a tremendous transformation of the American attitude towards the war on terror in general, and most specifically the war in Iraq. As you may be aware, we had well over 100,000 people in the streets in Washington, D.C., calling for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. As a consequence of that, there is greater focus also on the situation in Guantanamo and also, of course, the broader archipelago of shame, in which the U.S. holds, without any access to legal recourse, hundreds, perhaps thousands of prisoners. They call them detainees, they call them unlawful combatants, under terrible conditions. There is a growing concern about that in the United States as well. We had demonstrations several weeks ago here in D.C. where hundreds of individuals marched through the city in orange jumpsuits with black hoods, symbolizing the plight of those people in Guantanamo, while approximately 100 of us infiltrated the federal district court and staged a demonstration, submitting ourselves to arrest as a protest.
And arrest is a central thing, isn't it? Does the American population get that the new military laws means a removal of habeas corpus and what that entails? You know, no access to lawyers, no presentation before a court, no
right.
There is
a very serious campaign to acquaint the American people with that. This is the Military Commission Act, which was passed just before the elections last year. And it basically strips people of habeas corpus rights. It's not well enough known in the United States, but the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights and a number of other organizations are working very hard to bring this tragedy, this travesty, to the attention of the American people. And once again, hopefully with the change in Congress, we might be able to overturn that law. The very specific problem is that in the Senate, we would need 60 votes, and there are only 51 Democrats. So it's going to be particularly hard in the Senate to get that Military Commission Act defeated and turned around, whereas we think we could probably do it in the House.
Going back to the issue of self-determination that West Papua so well highlights, when governments don't give people a say in their destiny, they're looking for trouble. The governing body for Australian Aboriginal people, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, was dismantled by the Conservative Howard government about 2 years ago now. What effect do you think this has had on Aboriginal people, Jim?
The Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody pointed to self-determination as one of the essential ways of addressing the systemic disempowerment of Indigenous people in Australia, but ATSIC has now been removed. And of course, part of the process for doing that was to demonise ATSIC and to demonise a lot of ATSIC commissioners and paint a picture for the Australian community of an organisation which was ineffective or corrupt or inadequate, and that was the precursor to removing it. What it means is that while Indigenous people in Australia too had concerns about ATSIC and its effectiveness, there is no single recognised voice or forum for Indigenous issues to be raised and pursued. The mechanism for communication and clarification of issues and development of policy is removed by the removal of ATSIC.
And I'm wondering, Ed, if this is ringing bells for you. It seems to me that on an international level, Indonesia demonises West Papuan advocates as well.
It certainly does. Another aspect of what Indonesia has done in the past, though, is to trivialize their concerns and also essentially to dehumanize them. They are often reflected in government propaganda as something subhuman, basically people who are uncivilized and who therefore desperately need the benighted care of the Indonesian government. This is an example of racism, which I think is at the heart of a lot of the manner in which central governments deal with oppressed peoples.
Jim?
Well, it's interesting because that attitude, of course, was the justification, for example, the forced removal of kids from their families to say that this is for their benefit, and that both culturally and economically, Aboriginal families are doomed, and therefore that was the basis for those processes of assimilation. And in fact, what Ed describes as occurring in West Papua sounds like a condensed and accelerated process of dispossession that was used in Australia and elsewhere with, you know, reprisal killings, the suppression of language, the taking of land, medical neglect and exclusion of commentators and supporters, all of which occurred over a couple of centuries in Australia, has been accelerated in West Papua. And in Australia, there are dozens of reports that reveal the extent of disadvantage in health and socioeconomic terms, and yet governments that have failed to come up with a single policy to adequately address that will constantly blame and demonise the Aboriginal community for that continuing.
Yes, I remember that well in West Papua, watching a television program in the Highlands about why there was so much unemployment in West Papua. Well, there's unemployment in West Papua because there aren't job opportunities and because the Indonesians, not the West Papuans, get the best education. But here was this Indonesian reporter telling everybody in Indonesia that it was because the West Papuans were lazy. And that certainly had resonance, I think, to the Aboriginal population and what I see in reports of Aboriginal populations and also Indigenous populations in America too.
I recall one of my early visits out to West Papua, speaking with an intellectual of whom there are a goodly number in Jayapura, Papuan, and I asked him the basic question, well, do you consider yourself to be an Indonesian? And he said, that's the wrong question. The Indonesians don't consider me to be an Indonesian.
Yes, that's a very telling point too. Great to hear from you today, Ed. That was Edmund McWilliams, a former political counsel in the US Embassy in Jakarta, Indonesia. Great to have you on the program, Ed. Talk to you again
soon. Thank you very much.
going now to the highlands of Papua New Guinea. Picture this scene. An order came from a woman, a person you couldn't ignore. Energy seemed to flow from her, the type of energy that could mobilise people and stop bulldozers. "You follow me. I want you to see something," she said. So a young law student obeyed, following the woman onto her land in Wawawigawi in Papua New Guinea's western province. The fledgling advocate was shocked by what she saw. River waters that had been sullied by both soil loosened by logging and chemicals used to preserve the felled trees. Logs that had been ploughed into the earth, sticking out of the denuded surface. This was sacred ground, a sago-making area, but it looked like the aftermath of a volcano. The woman turned to the law student, Annie Kajir, and said, "You're a lawyer, you stop the logging. What did you do, Annie?"
Well, immediately I said, "I'm not a lawyer. I can't do that for you. I can't promise you anything, but I'll do my best for you, if you bear with me." I completed my law degree, and then eventually I was sent back into the area to obtain proper instructions and put together a brief to council so that council could actually give us an opinion. And we did that by going through to QC, a Brisbane-based barrister, who initially gave us the advice on how to start the action. The process also involved collating evidence from the area, and we hired environmental scientists to go into the area and conduct an environmental impact assessment, a preliminary investigation, rather. And that report formed the basis of us launching the action. There are two separate actions now on foot in the National Court. One is basically on trespass, and the other questions the validity of the timber permit granted to the company to log in the area. Right now, we've just gone through the process of amending the writ filed originally, and it's supposed to be back in court, I think, in early February.
So you're a lawyer that's not just a lawyer, are you? I mean, you're taking the view that the rape of resources in Papua New Guinea can't just be handled by law. And in terms of your work, the last time we talked last year, you were saying that your lobbying with advocacy groups in Papua New Guinea had resulted in an enormous drop of European trade in Papua New Guinea wood. Tell us about that advocacy and what's been involved with that.
Right. The NGOs basically in Papua New Guinea have, over a period of time, maybe 5 years now, 10 years now, lobbying internationally for countries to look into the issues of illegal logging and basically reduce the amount of wood that they're importing from Papua New Guinea. Successful lobbying with the European Union has seen a decrease in their imports, and I think that still remains the standard up until now. The British government has also committed itself in trying to address the issue of illegal logging in Papua New Guinea by sponsoring, so far, one meeting that was held last year and another one coming up in March this year. But at least we see a commitment from them in trying to help us get through this issue. You see, the problem is with the government of Papua New Guinea. It's not with the overseas market. It's the problem of corruption in the forestry industry in Papua New Guinea. If you can clean that up, then it becomes easier.
And can you explain that to us?
The government has sanctioned quite a number of independent reports, beginning with bringing in the World Bank to conduct independent investigations into the logging operations of Papua New Guinea. Now, those reports clearly state that the issuing of timber permits or licenses to companies haven't been done in line with our laws, and has made specific recommendations that the government of Papua New Guinea, you know, implement that hasn't been done. Yet we see the government of Papua New Guinea continuing its support to the logging industry and refusing calls for things like a commission of inquiry.
Mm. Because it's huge in Papua New Guinea, isn't it? As much as 46% of the forests have already been sold as concessions to the logging industry.
That's right. And it's being predicted that we have 16 more years to go before all our forests are depleted.
You've recently been in China, Annie. How did you go there? Did you have as much success there as you had with the Europeans?
Well, China is quite hard to lobby in, basically because of the kind of government that they have. But it was a success in that it was for the first time that the Department of Commerce in China allowed an environmental NGO, an environmental group, including me, to go in and have a formal meeting with them about what our issues were, what our concerns about logging were, and that China, being the major exporter, should at least reduce its amount of log imports into China because we consider it as illegal. The secretary who met us was quite diplomatic. He realized China had a problem there, and that he said he would raise it with government. But again, whether or not the issue gets seriously raised with the Chinese government is a different story. Otherwise, there was good media coverage, educational awareness among, you know, civil society groups, citizens, ordinary citizens. I spoke to the women, youth groups about illegal logging in Papua New Guinea and asking them to at least be mindful of what they buy from their shops, including things like chopsticks.
We tend to see China as a monolith, a bamboo curtain with this solid mass of people behind, but it's in fact worth bearing in mind that there's a lot of activity in environmental groups within China at this particular moment in time. Jim, I'm wondering whether or not what Annie's been talking about in terms of the links between government and those companies who rip off resources is resonating with you at all in terms of your work in Cape York.
Yeah, I think that's right, Chris and Annie. I mean, across northern Australia, there are many examples of where Indigenous people have opposed particular developments, either because they involve the destruction of sacred sites or environmental destruction. But even where the Indigenous communities have said, well, look, we're interested in this because of the economic opportunities it provides us, the state has delayed the legal recognition of native title and therefore prevented or limited the opportunity for the Indigenous people to be in there negotiating with the developer. And even once Indigenous people get to the negotiation table, their negotiations are hampered by lack of resources and also, I guess, the support of the state for the developer in those negotiations, because states want to be seen as pro-development and also have a vested interest in receiving, for example, the royalties from mining ventures.
As I understand it, Annie, your problem is a little bit the opposite, that you have Indigenous landowners but don't realise the value of the resources they're holding at that particular moment in time and perhaps give them over too quickly.
That's right. The basic problem here is that, as you probably know, 97% of the land is customarily owned. And in order for you to go into large-scale logging, you'd have to get prior informed consent from the landowners, meaning that you'd have to properly educate them about what their rights are and what they are entitled to negotiate. In most of the cases, that doesn't happen. You find that they are misled into believing that should they give away their forest resources, then they get infrastructure development, roads, schools, bridges, stuff like that.
That was Annie Kajir, the Chief Executive Officer of the Environmental Law Centre in Port Moresby. Terrific, Annie. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's it from today's New Internationalists. Join us same time, same place on the dial next week when campaigners from all corners of the globe are planning to drop in for a chat. Thanks, as always, to our studio producer, Rachel Maher, and thanks to Australian human rights lawyer Jim Brooks. Glad you could join us today, Jim. Thank you. The music that we've been playing comes from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. This week's musical interludes are from Renee LaSalle and Bob Brosman's fabulous album Dig Dig, where the pulse of the Pacific melts into the arms of bluegrass and Latin. You'll find them on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. I'm Chris Richards. Talk with you soon.